On FM, Book of the Week. Tracy Ann Oberman continues Leaving Before the Rains Come, Alexandra Fuller's follow-up to her best-selling memoir Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, charting her eccentric upbringing in southern Africa. Today, Alexandra has married the American adventurer Charlie, the man she hopes will save her from the chaos of her life, only to discover that it's perhaps wise to be careful what you wish for. But first, a tentative glimpse into her parents' family history.
From my earliest memory of her, Mum spoke longingly of her childhood in Kenya and of her own parents. She adored her English father and took pride in coming from mad, savage Scottish stock on her mother's side. By contrast, I knew almost nothing of my English father or his people. He seemed airdropped upon us, formed from soil and water, like Adam. Instinctively, I created the parameters of my father's family and heritage from the habits and adages that had slipped out of his Englishness and into our African lives, their peculiarities made more vivid by their inappropriateness for either our climate or lifestyle. "Bath and dress before dinner," Dad always insisted. "For whom?" I wanted to know, looking out into the unpeopled farmyards around us, the empty dirt roads. "It's just a rule. Let your socks sag and your spine will follow." So we came to dinner at 8, dressed as if for the captain's table, although I knew that ours was really a lifeboat, flung out into the high sea of disorder. "Bloody dogs," Dad said, kicking indiscriminately under the table. He put his revolver next to his side plate. Mum put her Uzi on an empty chair beside her. "Safety on?" Dad always asked. "Those things are liable to go off at the touch of a gnat's testicle." Then Dad asked for us to pass the green beans or the chicken, and we helped ourselves to supper. "Footman's night off," Dad said, every night, and that was the signal that we were now expected to be charming and entertaining, making light of the day's hardships, engaging in competitive banter. And regardless of reality, Mum occasionally sliding off her chair, the dogs always squabbling at our ankles, and the odd distant explosion of a landmine in the hills behind the house, we kept up the banter, as if practicing for a time we might be called upon to sing slightly off-colour sea shanties as the ship went down. We would not, God forbid, go native. It took a fluid mind to navigate the choppy waters of my father's unwritten rules. Some swearing was fine. Over-refined use of language was not. Dancing on the table was encouraged. Elbows on the table were not. It was only much later that I was able to trace the root of my father's uncompromising insistence that we be present at dinner to his own mother's chronic inability to make it to the table at night. Because as far as he was concerned, you weren't irrevocably off course and permanently lost at sea until you could no longer steer your way towards the evening meal, properly attired. While my mother's family was mentally ill in ways that should have had a wing of the local hospital dedicated to their memory, my father's side seemed to put most of their genetic energy into producing at least one seriously impressive drunk every other generation or so. It was as if all the stirrup cups, pims and a snifter before dinner, all the genteel drinking that went along with their masked dances, occasionally tidal pooled into a tragic, dipsomaniacal disaster. My great-great-grandmother, Mary Mortimer Garrod, fell backwards into a fireplace, drunk as a lord, and died. "Well, she was Australian," Dad explained, "and also probably pretty flammable by then." Possibly to make up for his catastrophically intoxicated mother, my great-grandfather married a woman of God-fearing, sober habits, who gave birth to half a dozen daughters, including a set of twins, of whom my father's mother, Boofy, was one. As the six Garrod sisters grew up and war loomed, field days and garden fetes turned into weekends entertaining cavalry officers. But there was a cost to their casual boozing. Five of the six sisters seemed able to steer out of the incessant rounds of revelry and into marriage. Something swamped in Boofy, though. And while everyone around her was joking about intoxication, she was a sopping mess on the floor of the bathroom, draped helplessly over the banisters, flopped unfixed across her dressing table before dinner. It was a relief when she too could be married off. But I think of how unhappy Boofy must have been, so soddenly drunk all day that she manifested to my father and his younger brother only as a kind of washed-out absence. Terrible waste of a life, Dad says. No life at all, really. From the start, Boofy could not even be trusted to hold her own children. A Norland nurse was hired for that. And so Noo became the most solid presence in my father's early life. Caped with a hat and white gloves, she took the boys on improving daily walks and taught them to recognize birds, bird songs, and wild plants. When my father left for boarding school, Noo wrote him a letter every Sunday. And every Sunday, he replied. Decades later, when she died, an early letter from Dad was found among Noo's possessions. It is a crayoned imaginary self-portrait. A little boy standing next to a giraffe, below which my father, improbably prescient, has written, "Dear Noo, I am going to Africa to see a giraffe. Yours sincerely, Timothy Fuller." It was the emotional iciness of England my father could not stand, not the actual climate with its famously drenching low skies. I left England like my arse was on fire. It was the pity I couldn't bear. After the house broke up, everyone felt sorry for us. To say someone has lost her mind does not do justice to what madness looks like. A person whose mind has gone is lost to herself as well as to the world. She becomes a shell of terror in search of what is missing. What is confusing, from the outside, is that a madwoman might still have relatively long periods when her mind is restored to her. I watched my mother go mad. Afterwards, when I tried to put a time on it, I would have said her mind left her when I was around 11, and she did not conjure or will it back until I was in my late 20s. But my mother's absence wasn't anything like a solid washout, a Boofy-like obliteration. It was drier than that, more as if an internal current had shorted and flickering outages would occur, only to suddenly trip on again. I have the shape of my mother's face, her thick hands, her short torso, her thin, long legs.
"Wonderful leg for a riding boot," Dad always said charitably of our underpinnings,
and her unswaying staccato walk. And in the way of all daughters, I watch my mother for clues to my future. I look back to my grandmothers and to their mothers, and regardless of their true talents and ambitions, the women whose blood rushed directly into mine were basically glorified housekeepers, their fates inextricably tied to the men they married. Like all newlyweds, I thought I'd made a contract of a different sort with my spouse, a fresh pact. I thought that Charlie and I would operate out of our own unique and complete love. But the Polish priest at our wedding had been right. The first year was hard. And after that, well, it didn't get worse immediately, but it got more and more silent. And silence frightened me. To begin with, we rented a sterile house on the outskirts of Lusaka. The main attraction was the land, 7 walled acres. But the house was a dismaying thing, long and dark and bricked up, clinical. An Indian businessman had built it during the 1980s, when the city was becoming increasingly violent, and it embodied his stifling paranoia. Bars on the tiny windows, a metal door with a huge padlock to separate the bedrooms from the rest of the house. Charlie's days were full of dreary government meetings and business plans, and putting together safari itineraries for clients. My days stretched ahead of me interminably. With a British passport and nothing but a Bachelor of Arts to my name, I was both foreign and underqualified, and I'd been denied a work permit by the Zambian government. It was as if, marrying Charlie, I had stepped across some invisible membrane into another country. This wasn't my Zambia. Days of unstructured freedom on the farm, chaos at the dinner table with our cook Adamson's undercooked chickens. This was someone else's idea of Zambia. In the evenings, Charlie came home exhausted.
and exuded an air of wearied disappointment. We sat in near silence over dinner. No dancing on the table, no dogs churning at our feet, moderation, bloodless poultry. On the few occasions Mum and Dad came up from the farm to stay, they too were subdued and orderly, especially after Charlie expressed his understandable opinion that we all drank too much. It's what I'd wanted, a ticket out of disorder and into calm. But now that I was here, I felt imprisoned, suffocated. Charlie found me temporary illegal work with an architect whose secretary was on vacation. I was bad at being a housewife, but worse at being a secretary. My boss didn't fire me, but he sounded relieved when one morning in mid-February I got too sick to go to work. It began with a wave of nausea at breakfast, spread to a headache by lunch, and finished with overwhelming exhaustion by dinner. Mum came up from the farm and took one look at me and announced her diagnosis. "You're pregnant." "I can't be," I said. "I have an IUD in." Mum sighed and shut her eyes. "Oh, don't go into the gory details, Bobo. Just take my word for it." By August, Charlie's work wasn't going well. The canoe and walking safaris were cancelled. Charlie needed to move closer to the white water rafting operations below Victoria Falls. So we packed up the house and rented a cottage on the banks of the Zambezi. I worried about being alone for the delivery, by which I meant I was worried about being beyond the reach of anyone related to me by blood. So Mum joined us, her hair slightly askew, her eyes pale to yellow, and her hands more unsteady than normal. I could tell it was a great effort of will for her to stay on the surface of her mind, to keep her madness at bay. She had difficulty concentrating. She drank a little too much too early. Her sentences sometimes came out of sequence, slurred and breaking the bounds of customary logic. In the mornings we went for walks around the lodge. In the afternoons we drank tea under the flamboyant trees in the yard and read. Then on September 15th, 1993, the slight contractions I'd been having all week tugged stronger. We drove to the little clinic nearby, and the midwife declared the baby ready for arrival. I laboured hard for 8 hours. I pushed and breathed and pushed and breathed and told myself I'd never do this again. Then there was an abrupt release, and there she was, a long-limbed, waxy, blood-smeared baby, unfurling on my chest, her lips a perfect rosebud of query, and everything I ever thought I knew about pain and love and fear of death raced out of me and was replaced by a fierce, murderous adoration. I looked at Mum in astonishment. "I know," she said, and for a moment something swam between us that had to do with the children she had lost, although it wasn't anything I was prepared to put into words. The baby closed her mouth over my nipple. Mum pulled the sheet back off my stomach with careful apprehension, as if expecting to unearth a small but vicious animal, and allowed herself a proper inspection of her first granddaughter. "Well, at least she has a nice leg for a riding boot," she said, at last.
And tomorrow, the move to America, as Tracy Ann Oberman continues reading Leaving Before the Rains Come by Alexandra Fuller. It was abridged by Richard Hamilton and produced by Justine Willett. After the news, Women's Hour.
What am I doing here on this bright, cold morning?
A love affair with extraordinary consequences.
No one ever expects anybody to die at the least opportune of moments.
Reading Europe continues with a Spanish tale of secrets.
I could do him now. I've got the tape. Just play it. Reveal what he's been up to. I could do it now.
Tomorrow in the Battle, Think on Me. On Sunday afternoon at 3, and then available on the BBC Radio 4 website.